Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic podcast. Julie Bindle is in conversation with Raquel Rosario Sanchez about the bullying and harassment she has faced at Bristol University.
I'm Julie Bindle and I'm here with Raquel Rosario Sanchez. And Raquel is taking action against her university on the grounds of sex discrimination and negligence. After she has been through hell, I'd say, and she's going to talk about that. And Raquel has taken this drastic course of action because after her many, many complaints over a lengthy period of time to Bristol University, about the bullying and harassment by trans activists. They dismissed those complaints. In fact, doubled down in their support of trans activists, we would say. Raquel, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me and thank you for the opportunity to speak directly to people. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's been happening in the media, but I really appreciate the opportunity to speak directly and so that people can hear my voice. Because oftentimes you hear those names and you see those pictures, but it's important for people to listen so that they can get the sense that there's a real person behind the headlines.
Well, we've met each other on several occasions, and in fact we met right at the very beginning of this nightmare, didn't we? In 2018. But I want to go back before then, and I want to ask about you, about your earlier life. You're 32 years of age, is that right? So tell us about how you got to the UK. What happened before then?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic. And from a very young age, I was involved in campaigning, and mainly through children's rights, and then that developed into women's rights. And I went to Utah State, where I did a bachelor's degree with a minor in women and gender studies. And then I went back home and I worked on violence against women at the Ministry of Women. I left again to go do a master's degree at Oregon State. And my master's degree was in women, gender and sexuality studies. And then I went back home and I worked at the shelter work department at the Ministry of Women again. And then I decided, like, I really feel passionate about my topic. And my academic topic is men who pay for sex. And I just felt very passionate, and I applied to a number of PhD programs around the world, like maybe 6 or 8, and I got unconditional offers from most of them. But what really drew me to Bristol is that they had a whole center dedicated to ending violence against women. And I wanted to be a part of that center. I wanted to be among a team of people who were all working together to end violence against women. That's how I got to Bristol. In essence, I have been studying women and gender studies for the past decade.
Well, you know, I'm quite in awe, really, because you've done so much in your life and you've achieved such a lot. But one thing that connects us and other feminists is the very contested area of looking critically at the sex trade. And you've actually honed that down even more specifically, haven't you, to the demand, the men that drive the abuse of, the commercial abuse of women. Yeah. Tell me what actually started your interest in that.
What started my interest, particularly in sex buyers, is that I wanted to focus on the sex trade, but I noticed that every time you had a conversation about prostitution, it became some sort of theoretical debate about women's choices. Is it a free choice? Is she empowered? Is she exploited? Is she abused? And then in academia, when you want to study and work in prostitution, that debate consumes everything. It's just an endless conversation about women's choices. And I just thought, well, hold on a minute. The only thing that they have in common, these two positions, is that it is overwhelmingly men who are driving this demand. So I didn't want to spend my academic career focusing on women's choices. I wanted to focus my work in men's choices, because as you explain in so many of your books and your work, you know, it is men who are making the choice of, like, well, which woman do I want to visit? What kind of services, quote unquote, do I want? You know, what time of day am I going to get this? They make so many choices along the way, but in the current debate about prostitution, we are so focused on centering women in the debate. And I think that that's strategic to invisibilize the people who have the real power behind this, which is men.
It's interesting, and we're going to talk, obviously, in the main during this discussion about the targeting by trans activists of you. But already, when you chose to look at this topic of men paying for sex, of men's entitlement to pay for sex, you're on difficult ground, aren't you? And I know this from looking very closely within academia and the what I call the trafficking deniers, the sex trade apologists. So you were already kind of fighting a battle to bring this feminist approach to a global atrocity against women and girls.
Yeah, and when I looked at many departments around the world, you know, like women's studies and gender studies department, like the vast majority of them come from the perspective of like, well, sex work is work, and this is about empowering women to make choices, to become, you know, escorts and that kind of stuff. And something that was really important to me is that the Center for Gender and Violence Research was explicit in naming prostitution as a form of abuse against women. And if you are familiar with the topic of prostitution in academia, that's like a rare jewel.
Yes, it is.
You know, it's just so rare to find academics, especially feminist academics, who don't want to toe the line of the pink lobby.
That's right. And they'll use a slur of white feminist, even against women of colour such as yourself. I've heard Native women in Canada and Indigenous Aboriginal women in Australia who were sex trade survivors and abolitionists be hit with the slur of white feminist because the academy has become so invested in this neoliberal notion that everything's about choice and everything's about an individual identity. So you're clearly, I suppose, what I'm trying to establish here, just in case anyone was disabused of this, is you are an extremely courageous, tenacious woman. So we get to 2018. Tell me what happened when this trouble first started.
It started almost as soon as I got to Bristol. So for whatever reason, there were a number of issues with my student visa and with my scholarship, and that meant that I arrived at the University of Bristol during a weird time. You know, the term is supposed to start, I think it's August or September, but I arrived in the UK towards the middle to the end of November. So that meant that I was kind of by myself most of the time. But because I was already an established writer and campaigner, women knew about my work, and I was approached by some women to share a meeting for Woman Space UK. Woman Space UK is a political campaigning feminist organization here in the UK, and they were hosting meetings all over the country just to have a conversation about the sex and gender debate and about the policy ramifications of the proposed reform of the Gender Recognition Act. So I agreed to share the Bristol meeting. It's important for me to say that I wasn't even speaking at that meeting. I was just sharing a meeting, facilitating a conversation. And it was so natural to me. You know, I'm studying social policy at the Center for Gender and Violence Research. My complete professional and academic field is ending violence against women. Of course, I have a right to participate in conversations about public policy and about women's rights. But trans activist students at the University of Bristol, they thought that that was unacceptable. And they decided to initiate a campaign of intimidation and vilification. And that kicked off towards in January 2018, and it just carried on.
Well, I just want to make one thing clear, and I know you share my view on this, is that we only involve ourselves in this debate because we do, as you've just explained, dedicate our feminist work and, in your case, study to ending male violence towards women and girls. And we only have separate spaces and sex-based legal rights because of male violence, because there are enough men for it to become a safeguarding issue. So isn't it the case that we're only actually invested at all in this debate about whether gender should trump sex, because we need to keep those women's spaces because of rape and domestic abuse.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I also want to say that the thing that particularly got me concerned about the sex and gender debate, the so-called trans issue, is that I was witnessing how trans activists were behaving towards feminists. And I saw the assault, the physical assault on Maria McLachlan that happened in Speaker's Corner in 2017. I saw similar attacks towards feminists by trans activists in different parts of the world. And I was concerned mostly about what I consider to be the normalization of male violence in political discourse. And I thought that is extremely dangerous for democracy, that is extremely dangerous for the political sphere. And I felt that it was some sort of duty for me, well, Raquel, if this is the work that you do, your whole thing is male violence against women, then you need to step up and you need to get involved and try to find a way to bring some sensitivity, to try to shed some light in a way that takes some of the heat out of this conversation. So I saw it as just sort of a responsibility, because I thought that, and I continue to think, that it is extremely dangerous when you normalize violence against women in political discourse.
Absolutely. And obviously, Bristol University is a prestigious institution, but Bristol as a city does have its fair share of extreme trans activists, doesn't it? I mean, I faced them. I think it was shortly after this trouble all kicked off for you, and you were bullied and harassed and defamed. And I went along as a reporter, not to speak, at an event in a venue in Bristol. Again, hosted by women that wanted to highlight the safeguarding dangers if we lose our single-sex spaces. And I was blocked on the stairwell by trans activists with masks and balaclavas. I was pushed, my phone was knocked out of my hand, there were others that were threatened to be thrown down the stairs. It was very intimidating and scary. The police did nothing. And I was really shocked that that level of vitriol was allowed to invade a space where feminists were talking about male violence. We saw it with our own eyes, that male intimidation. Yes, many of them might have identified as they, them, or trans women, but they were clearly very male and clearly very abusive.
And they were students at the University of Bristol. There were students at the University of Bristol. You're referring to the Jam Jar event that took place on the 18th of April, 2018. And there is video on YouTube in which you can see students at the University of Bristol blocking the stairs, trying to prevent a feminist meeting from taking place by essentially just blocking women from coming into the venue. There's also video of trans activist students at the University of Bristol forcing their way into the room to attack feminists. Some of these students wrote about wanting to detonate a smoke bomb in an enclosed space. I mean, just take a second to pause and think about what that means. You know, you have women who have respiratory issues, like myself, for example, or women of a certain age, you know, who could be seriously harmed by those sort of actions. So you have students, trans activist students at the University of Bristol who are behaving that way openly and publicly towards feminists. And you can watch some of this behavior in a Channel 4 documentary called Trans Kids that was created by Stella O'Malley. But the point that I want to make is you are exactly right. All of this intimidation happened and the university was aware that this was happening. The university was aware that these were their students at the time, and still they did nothing.
Okay, so let's drill down into some detail here. Obviously, what happened to you is appalling. I've seen the evidence, the imagery, the threats to you, the demands to shut down meetings, the warning of what would happen if you didn't, various threats of violence towards you on your own campus. Take us through what happened when you reported this, and if there's any particular scenario that you want to highlight that will paint a vivid picture, tell us about that, and then how the university responded to you and what they did with the trans activists.
was very confusing at the time because I was receiving very limited information. And when we go to court next week, then we will get a clearer picture. The public is going to get a clearer picture of what was going on behind the scenes. But from my perspective as a student, what I did is that I looked at everything that was happening to me regarding the Woman's Place meeting taking place in February 2018. And I said, well, this is unacceptable. You know, I went online and I looked at the policies that the university had, and I found policies that said bullying and harassment is not acceptable, it's not to be tolerated. Vilification, threatening behavior, that is not to be tolerated. And I grabbed those policies and I grabbed the evidence from trans activist students doing that to me, and I filed a complaint with the University of Bristol. And you can see that from very early on, they wanted to dismiss it. They wanted to wash their hands from it. They tried at so many different points to just make sure that the whole thing went away without them having to intervene in any way. And I just thought, well, but that's not acceptable. It is not acceptable to have this two-tier system in which you have policies that says bullying and harassment is unacceptable on this campus, except when it happens to feminists. Except when it happens to women. I just thought, well, I'm not putting up with that. That's not good enough. And I just kept pushing. And when I say that I kept pushing, I mean that I was just insistent. It was email after email. No, you're not going to dismiss me. No, I am not going to go away. There cannot be a system in which you have one first class type of students and then some second class students who have lesser rights. And I just demanded clarity and that my rights were upheld. I have a right to study, to work in an environment free from intimidation and from abuse. So I filed my student complaint. The university dragged its feet for a long time. They started some disciplinary process against some trans activist students. And then what the trans activist students would do is that they would just organize this protest in which they would get all their trans activist friends to show up in balaclavas and target those disciplinary hearings by leaking confidential information. And the university would say, oh, we have security concerns because of these trans activist protesters, so we have to cancel the hearings. So in effect, the trans activist students were able to just make a mockery of the disciplinary process, and the university would say things like, well, there are security concerns, so there's nothing that we can do other than to cancel this.
Well, they could have probably had them arrested.
I mean, and it was challenging for me because as a complainant, I was asked at one point to go to one of these hearings. And at one of those hearings on 15th of June, 2018, trans activists had organized a protest. There were students in trans activist students in balaclavas. They said that they would be distributing a pamphlet called Why We Fight the Turf War. And it was just very dehumanizing language about how disgusting and bigoted women like me are. That was really difficult. And the university said that this was important. It was important for me to attend this hearing. So I turned up and I was cross-examined by my bully's barrister. The bully got a barrister. And I was cross-examined by the bully's barristers, and I was asked questions about my feminist views, asked questions about my opinions, and I just thought, this is so dystopian. All I did was decide to share a meeting. All of these things are happening to me, and I'm the one being questioned. And at that hearing, the university never asked any questions of the trans activist student that they were allegedly investigating. They just...
No questions was asked of the aggressor?
No.
That's absolutely unbelievable.
At all. No questions at all. And in the whole time that disciplinary process wasn't going, that was like 16 months, they never asked them any questions.
So you were scrutinized. Your feminist beliefs were scrutinized.
Yes, exactly.
And so what happened? Did you continue to try to get justice through the complaints procedure?
Yeah, I decided, no, we're going to see this through. And I just kept pushing and kept pushing. There had to be some sort of conclusion. And what the university decided to do is, at one point, when I had already become very unwell, the university decided to terminate the disciplinary procedures, citing reasons unrelated to the merits of the case. They didn't explain what that means.
You still don't know what those reasons are?
Well, now I do. But we're going to find
out. We're going to find out next week when you're in court, which we'll talk a little about later.
Yes.
I know it's limited what you can say about the case, but we will actually alert people to the fact that this case is going ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, okay, so they dismissed the whole disciplinary thing in maybe, was it late June 2019, but they only dismissed my student complaint in December 2019. So take into account, I filed a student complaint on the 1st of February 2018, and they dismissed it on the 19th of December 2019. So almost 2 years. While this whole thing wasn't going, it was impacting my studies, it was impacting my health and my well-being. And it was like they thought that maybe I was going to drop it. Maybe I was going to just like get tired and just sort of like go away. And I didn't.
How did you study during this time? What was your life like?
It was very challenging. It was challenging because I wanted so badly to create a positive environment for me. You know, I mean, think about it this way. All my family is in the Dominican Republic. It's a little island in the Caribbean that is thousands of miles away from the UK. I came as an immigrant sort of on my own, decided to build my life from scratch. So much of my life was just connected to the university and I wanted things to work. And then when I was witnessing like the neglect that how the university was treating me, then it was like a slow erosion of my sense of self.
Mm.
And I became very unwell over the summer of 2019 because it was just too much. It's just an inordinate amount of stress, especially when you take into account, you know what, this is an immigrant woman in a country where she has no family.
Tell me, I know it's painful, but talk me through the effects that this has had on you from the beginning and ongoing, because obviously this case is not yet concluded.
Well, so from the beginning, I just tried to sort of... I've always been very certain that I haven't done anything wrong. You know, the policies are very clear. Bullying and harassment is unacceptable. And here I have all of this evidence of bullying and harassment. And then I just had this attitude of like, well, there's something going on here that is wrong. And I don't want to acquiesce to it. And I don't want to bend to it. I want to stand my ground. But then little by little, you know, you hear all of these messages of how horrible dehumanizing messages of people vilifying you and intimidating you. And that was difficult. But what I found most difficult was how the indifference of the University of Bristol and the way that they tried to criticize me and to blame me for the abuse that I was going through, that just completely had a real impact in my life. To the point that in my legal case, we're claiming that it created a psychological injury. So that's why we have the negligence claim. But I just want to make the point that I don't like to get too deep into that aspect of the case. And there's a very important reason why, and you're going to understand that perfectly. Abusers love to hear about how they have harmed you. You know? A bully and a harasser is not just about bullying and harassing you. It's also about knowing I am inflicting pain on this woman. That woman is having sleepless nights. That woman's energy levels are impaired. That woman is going through a really challenging time while all of this is ongoing. And I just feel like I don't want to give trans activism that. Like neither the students or the institution. So I tried very hard to privately, I know what I went through, but publicly what you saw was, well, there's Raquel giving another speech. There's Raquel writing another article. You saw sort of like the feminist campaigner who is very outspoken, very energetic, but privately was a very challenging situation.
I understand exactly what you're saying about the effects, about the cost of this. And I really relate to what you're saying here. And I understand about the tension between the importance of making it clear publicly and legally about the costs of this to us, as we do all the time about male violence, and I see this as part of that, but also not wanting to lose our strength or to help the bullies use you, me, Kathleen Stock, or whoever the latest target is, as a warning to younger feminists, maybe those that are less outspoken, have fewer resources.
Yeah, like you see, I just want to say something to our audience, and is that when it comes to these legal cases that are being brought by overwhelmingly women, you see these women and you think, oh, that's a warrior woman. You know, she's so strong. She's so brave. And I just want to remind the public that, you know, behind all these faces, there are human beings. And there are women who are going, speaking for myself, for example, there are women who are going through some of the most difficult times in our lives. And it's not like you sit in a lab and you say, I'm going to construct this perfect legal case and this is all going to go this way. I want people to know, you know what, it's a human person behind all of this who is doing her best, but who's not perfect. And I'm not perfect. I am not a saint. I want all my donors to know that I am not a saint. But I just had this very strong conviction that what's happening to women in academia who stand up for safe-based rights is unacceptable.
Yes.
And you see, for example, you know, Joe Phoenix, who is a professor who is now currently suing the Open University. Like, when all of this was happening to her, her mom was dying. When all of this was happening to me, I had no family around me to give me a hug when I had a really hard day. So I just wanted people to keep in mind that, you know, behind these faces and the cases, there are real people who are just trying to do the best that they can under some inordinate amount of stress and anxiety.
It's quite sadistic, isn't it? And I think we can talk about the students forever, but we also need to focus on the institution and on the senior academics that go along with this or perpetuate this behaviour and fail to protect you. And I can't help but think that in 2018, when these masked, balaclavaed Antifa types were running around spray painting slogans, distributing vile leaflets, text and images through social media or around the university, that had the university taken the appropriate action against them, this very similar crowd that met Kathleen Stock last year at Sussex University, where she walked through the underpass on the way into her place of work and found slogans and threats spray painted about her, saw the leaflets, saw the social media vile chat about her. They had an opportunity to send out a warning to these students, didn't they? But they turn up again 3 years later and harass and intimidate Kathleen Stock.
Yeah. And they felt, now they feel entitled or and empowered by what they did to these women. You know, I respect that every woman is different and she knows the circumstances of her life. But those students who bullied Kathleen Stock, they get a sense of pride of knowing, you know what, this woman, all she wanted to do was do this job at this university, and I took that from her. And something that I want to be very clear about to our audience is that trans activism and the institutions that enable trans activism to abuse women, they want to know that they took something from you. You know, the reality today is that I came to Bristol, to the UK, with a set of hopes and excitement, and I was just so happy. You know, I felt like, oh my God, I can't believe that this is real. And that was, things changed, you know. I didn't have the experience that I was supposed to have. But I have been so determined to create a life for myself that is not just pain, that is not just suffering. because that is what trans activism wants. They want to know that you are miserable. So I have decided that I will not be miserable. So I made the decision of like hosting feminist meetings and writing articles and just taking advantage of the opportunities that I have been able to create for myself. And when we go to court next week, you're going to have the University of Bristol complaining, oh, well, she couldn't be so harmed by all of this because she kept writing articles. And she this yeah. couldn't be so serious because she just kept having meetings. And it's like, yes, I live my life because it's a catch-22, especially if you're an international student. You know, if you're laying in bed and you cannot get out of bed, you cannot even shower because you're so depressed, then they can take action against your studies and say, well, you're a non-functioning student. Why are you here? There are thousands of top students who can do what you're doing, who can have your position. But if you go out there and show that you're like a capable, successful person, then they use that against you by saying, well, but you cannot be in any way harmed if you're still a functioning individual.
Of course they do. And obviously the best thing that we can do is for your life to get back on course, for you to get that PhD that you should be holding right now, and to, as you say, live a happy and fulfilled life. And the next stage in this fight is the court case, isn't it? Tell me how we got there. You decided to help with the university system. I'm going to sue them.
Well, it was a very protracted decision because it is not what I wanted to do. I wanted the complete opposite. I wanted to work and collaborate with the university. I just wanted them to see I haven't done anything wrong. This is just a basic matter of, does the evidence show bullying harassment? So I spent 2 years working alongside the university, trying to get them to see sense. And in the end, they dismissed me. And they dismissed me in a very horrible way. And then I made the decision, okay, so what do I do now? I have the option of living a quiet life and just accepting my status as a second-class student. And I thought that that was not good enough. Because if it was happening to me, then that means that it is happening to other women. And I felt that it was very important. I continue to think that the most important thing about my case is that we get some clarity. Does the policy about bullying and harassment apply to female students? Can female students and professors at universities around the UK, can they expect to be protected from abuse when this is done by trans activists? You know, it is just not good enough to say, well, there was like this big thing that happened with Raquel and then let's just pretend that it didn't. It's like, right. Well, no, we need clarity. And that's the only thing that I'm hoping to achieve with this legal case. And it was a very painful decision because, I mean, especially as an international student, I left my family, I left my country, I left my language, I left my food, my weather, for this very lovely weather here in the UK, from the Caribbean.
Don't criticize our weather.
Yes, I left all of that, my dog. To come to this university thinking, you know, this is a top university, I'm going to become a great expert through the stuff that I'm going to learn here. So to have that dream sort of shatter and have to make the decision of like, I need to go through this very difficult process, going to court is just difficult. It challenges you in ways that you would not anticipate. Like that was a painful process. And I would like to say, you know, when you make this decision of, I'm going to go to court, it has to be a very serious thought process that you go through. Because I have found that over the past 2 years, since I lost my legal case, like my thought process and my principles and the things that matter to me, they have been tested so much because you're making all of these decisions under so much stress and pressure. And you have the eyes of thousands of people who are supporting you, but also detractors. So I just want everyone to reiterate the point of behind every face that you see out there, taking one of these cases, there's a person, and there's a person who is going through a lot. So,
and it's, I know, I recently settled in a case against Pink News. I sued them for defamation, and I know how expensive, and I know how time consuming and how stressful it is, but I want the listeners to give you some money if they haven't already, and even if they have given you some money, if you can afford it, and I know not all of you can, if you can afford it, do the equivalent of buying Raquel a coffee. Put some money in her crowdfund, which we're going to link to this interview, because obviously your lawyers are working extremely hard, they're not charging top dollar, but it's still really, really expensive. Tell us what it will look like in court, how long it's expected to last, and what the process will be.
So we are going to be in court from February 7th to February the 14th, and it will take place at the Bristol Civil Justice Centre. And the first day, February 7th, is going to be a reading day for the judge, but then the rest of it is going to be in person.
Who will appear?
Well, the university has a QC barrister and their solicitor, and they have four staff members who are going to be testifying on their behalf against me. And then I will be speaking as a claimant, obviously, and the only witness that I have is Dr. Emma Williamson, who is the former head of the Center for Gender and Violence Research. And we are going to make a point about sex discrimination and how the overwhelming majority of people who campaign on sex-based rights are women. So we will be relying on some factual statements from Women's Place UK, Fair Play for Women, and Sex Matters.
What can listeners do, apart from put some money into your crowdfund, to support you?
You know, this is going to sound very simple, but I think that it is pivotal to any campaigning effort. And I think that if you cannot donate, or if you already have, I think that the most important thing that people can do is just have conversations with their friends and with their families about the sex and gender issue. You know, it is not those figureheads whose names are well known who create the change. We help, but the real change happens when people in their communities have the conversations that trans activists do not want you to have. You know, so what we need, not only in the UK political sphere, but internationally when it comes to this topic of gender identity and sex-based rights, what we need is to normalize having these conversations. What we need is to get a sense of, you know what, these are policy matters and people are allowed to have an opinion, and it is not okay to abuse people because they have an opinion that you do not like. So I think that that is something that people can do. I know that many women, some because they contact me, feel scared of bringing this conversation up among their groups of friends or at work or something like that. But it matters, and it changes the larger climate. And the more of us that speak out, if we can, in our communities or online, there are forms of activism that you can do anonymously. The more that we do that, then we create a shift, a collective shift.
Mm. I agree. I want to ask you a personal question. How have you coped?
I have coped through, I have tried hard to be as healthy as I can. So I have gone through like a lot of very long walks and just tried to be in nature as much as I can. But you know, I have to say something that was very surprising to myself was that I learned how to meditate after all of this happened. And I just have to say that meditation has been a lifesaver. Meditation just sort of saved my sanity. And this is something that if you had asked me 4 years ago, I would have been like, never. Me? No, I don't do that kind of stuff. I'm fighting yoga right now, but I think that I'm going to become a fanatic if I take it up. But in any case, like, yeah, every night before I go to bed, I just meditate. And it has very helpful to keep me grounded and centered. So when people are asking me right now, like, Raquel, how are you? You know, this must be like going crazy. It's like, yeah, it is intense. 4 days before the trial, but it has helped me feel all right in the middle, in the eye of the storm. So that has been very helpful.
And feminism, of course.
Oh, yes, of course.
I mean, we, you know, it's something that has revolutionized, you know, my struggle going through this kind of attack from the trans activists and their allies, because I'm part of a movement. And I know that for all of us, those of us that are in the public eye with this, there are so, so many women, mainly young women, that can't speak out and they need us. Yeah. And, you know, we were talking earlier, weren't we? We've kind of taken one for the team.
Yeah.
And it wasn't our choice, but yeah, we're not going to cave into them.
I also wanted to make a point about sort of the impact that targeting and intimidation has on women. And something that has been very helpful to me is to keep a sense of perspective. And this might be controversial, but because my field is violence against women, I try to remind myself, you know what, Raquel, what is happening to you is very difficult. But there are women out there who are being trafficked, who are having to be raped by men, dozens of men every day. There are children in this country and in every country who are being tortured. And right now, as we speak, there is a woman named Anika Atik in Pakistan who has just been sentenced to death under blasphemy laws over a conversation that she had in WhatsApp. So I have been trying my best to remind myself that this is difficult and challenging, but there is a big world out there full of injustices that need our energy, our passion, our drive. And that has helped sort of galvanize me every morning. And I just want to, it's not a criticism, but I have been very careful of how much I dwell into the negative impact of this. Because every time you see a headline that says, bullying destroyed my life, harassment and drove me mad or something like that. Like every time you see that, then there are thousands of women who see it and say, okay, well, I'm going to shut up and I'm never
yes,
talking about this.
I completely agree. And in fact, you know, I've long gone absolutely berserk about this whole narrative of rape destroyed my life. Mm-hmm. Giving evidence in court was like a second rape. Actually, no. Yes, sometimes women's lives are destroyed by male violence. We know this. But bearing in mind how many of us have been raped, we go on to become feminists or we just live our lives, or we thrive even.
Yeah.
And that has to be a message that we get out there.
Yeah, trans activism wants women to think, look at what I'm doing to J.K. Rowling. So if I can do that to J.K. Rowling, imagine what I'm going to do to you. And they want women to live in a state of fear. And I have been deliberate in trying to broadcast. Not only did bullying not ruin my life, but I have managed to create so many positive things in my life in spite of all of the challenges. Like, this conversation right now is surreal because when I graduated from my master's degree, my thesis, if you look at it, half of it is just me quoting your book and just saying to everyone, Julie Bindel is right about this. You need to listen to her. You know, so it's like, that was me when I was writing my master's degree, and today we're having this conversation, and I consider you to be my friend. So I think that if I had done what the bullies wanted of me, both the students and the institution, Bristol University, then I would have shut up and gone away. And I decided, no, you don't have the power to do that to my life. And I want women to know this is challenging, this is difficult, but you can move forward and create a life that is positive and do effective activism and campaigning.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm a great admirer of yours, as you know, and I consider you to be a friend. And we have a lot to thank you for standing up and refusing to be cowed. And this battle, and I wish we didn't have to fight it, because we have rape and femicide and all the other issues to deal with. But it's all part of that big battle. This battle, I've made some superb friends. I've found solidarity amongst women that previously I might have missed out on. Some men have become friends who've done the right thing. And also it's given me a real insight into how misogyny works when it's actually dressed in a different way.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have chosen it, but I'm actually grateful to be able to be in the fight and to have, like you, thrived. And I want to give all the luck in the world for your case, and we'll all be behind you. And one last question, if I may. When are we going to see your PhD? Because we need that PhD. We really need your work.
I'm hoping that... No. I am going to do the PhD. I want to do the PhD. I am keen to shed a light on men who pay for sex. It's an important topic. It is important because what is happening in prostitution, in the sex trade, is an abomination. And we really have to shift the focus from endless conversations about choice and empowerment, quote unquote, and just talk about the choices that men are making. So I want to do my PhD, whether the University of Bristol wants me to do that PhD, then that's another matter. And I just wanted to say something before we end the interview, which is that, you know, me going to court against the University of Bristol is not about me doing some sort of arrogant dance of like, look how perfect I am and look how terrible they are. It's not about arrogance. It's not about pointing the finger and saying you were awful. I want to be clear that there are many people at the University of Bristol who are amazing people, wonderful people, who just want to help, who want to help students, who want to pursue their interests, who want to advance knowledge. And there's a lot of people like that in the institution. It is just regrettable that decision makers at the University of Bristol have decided to take this corporate political stance that is unnecessary. All they had to do was just apply their policies equally to all students. And what I'm arguing is that they created arbitrary rules that prioritize trans activism over women's rights. And that was unnecessary. I just wanted to point out that it's not a case about being arrogant or trying to get revenge. It's not about that. It's about making sure that the University of Bristol, but also other universities around the UK, understand that their female students and their feminist students who advocate for sex-based rights, they are human beings who deserve the protection of their academic institutions.
Well, I think any university in the land would be very lucky to have you as a PhD candidate. So, Raquel, thank you very much for speaking to me today.
Thank you.
Don't forget, support Raquel. Where can they find you on Twitter?
@RosarioSanchez. Thank you to the audience.
Thank you. Thank you for listening.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.